From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Air Talk. Good morning, I'm Larry Mantle. The State Air Resources Board is warning California can't meet its climate goals with so many people driving. We'd have to cut miles driven by a quarter to meet the state's 2030 emission goal. That's even with more electric cars. But what's controversial is the board's recommendation to meet the standard. We'll debate it right after the news. Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Good to have you with us. Coming up, we'll remember the work of SpongeBob SquarePants creator Steven Hillenburg by considering the most influential TV animation of our lives, from early Tom and Jerry to Phineas and Ferb. That comes up later this hour, right here on KPECC. But we begin with a report released this week by the California Air Resources Board. It looked at efforts of the Golden State to meet greenhouse gas emission standards by the year 2030. The conclusion of the board's report is that California cannot meet that standard with people driving so many miles. As you know from driving our freeways, we've seen many more people purchase used cars, take to the roads. Driving is up considerably as gas prices have stayed comparatively low. Public transportation is generally less used. And as a result, we have more greenhouse gas emissions, more cars on the road. So CARB says what we need to do is to cut by 25% per capita the miles driven by Californians. That's the only way we're going to meet those standards. Well, is that realistic? With us, director of the nonprofit Climate Plan, Chanel Fletcher. Thank you very much, Ms. Fletcher, for joining us on Air Talk.
Thank you for having me. I'm very glad to be here.
Is this realistic that we would be able to cut our miles driven by such a large number?
You know, I think it is. And I know that number sounds really big. And I think that one of the things that I think we can talk about and do is actually make it much more scalable. And one of the things that CARB has released has also been that this number that sounds huge is actually, we're looking at individual people, it's driving 1.6 miles less every day. That's what it looks like. So we're not necessarily saying that everybody has to get out of their cars, everyone has to, like, you know, ride a bike, take a bus. But what we are saying is that if there are ways that you can make choices in your daily life where you can say, you know what, actually, maybe I will bike to the store instead of, you know, getting in my car, and that's 1 mile less, that actually, I think, improves both your physical health and I think also reduces greenhouse gas emissions. So there's definitely ways to do this where it's not, I think, this huge, immense kind of challenge where everybody has to jump out of their cars immediately.
I'd assume, though, that the bulk of the miles that are racked up are by people that are doing lengthy commutes. So they probably have less ability to curtail their driving than someone who lives closer to where he or she works and can, you know, find alternate means, maybe walk a little bit more, that sort of thing. So how do you get at that? I understand what you're saying on an average driver's cuts, but how do you get at where most of the miles are probably coming from?
And that's a great question. I think that's why one of the reasons why we're so excited about this report is because what it's really talking about is that we do need to make some changes to how we're planning growth and where growth happens and where it occurs. And one of the biggest things that I would say is thinking about where are we building our homes? Where are we building affordable homes? And what I think the trend that we've seen is that more and more kind of quote-unquote affordable homes tend to be further and further away from job centers. And which is, I think, like as you're mentioning, leading to those lengthy commutes. What we really liked about this report and one of the recommendations that we're fully supportive of is that we need to start seeing the cities and the counties and the regions start to work together to actually plan growth and in existing communities and the existing kind of urban footprint and making sure that that's accessible and affordable for all income levels, so people can actually be closer to their jobs and their schools, which will also just improve their quality of life, because nobody wants to be in the car for 2 hours.
We're talking with Chanel Fletcher, director of Climate Plan. It's a nonprofit based in the Bay Area. Jennifer Hernandez, land use and environmental attorney, leads her firm's West Coast Land Use and Environmental Group, and she's representing a civil rights pending lawsuit against the State Air Resources Board over their move into housing space. Joining us, Ms. Hernandez, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
So let's talk about the recommendations here. CARB essentially saying the best way to cut down on the miles driven is to lower restrictions to building more infill housing, higher density urban housing. That's the best way to meet greenhouse emission targets. Your response to that?
Well, I think that this is, frankly, a Sacramento bureaucratic blindness that has befallen CARB, which I hope is a little bit more focused on equity and civil rights than this proposal seems to indicate. The people who drive the furthest are those that are priced out of places that are closer to work. Those people are disproportionately younger, and they're disproportionately people of color. Senator Scott Wiener, who's a housing champion, just released a document saying over a million Californians, mostly lower-income workers, families, mostly people of color, have had to move out of the state because of high housing costs. And those high housing costs have driven them to states with lower housing costs, like Texas, where per capita greenhouse gas emissions are almost triple what Californians are. It's so disappointing to see CARB endorse an approach that requires even higher housing costs without actually supporting any of the changes that would be required, like allowing cities to simply implement plans they've already approved without risk of CEQA lawsuits that could actually cause production to occur. So we think this is an unlawful approach. We also think it completely ignores history. The Obama administration confirmed that tailpipe emissions from cars dropped 99% from the 1960s through the systematic application of rules that dropped emission and dropped pollution levels.
Most notably catalytic converters on cars.
We just started greenhouse gas emission reductions. We're getting an electric fleet. California is leading the way on transportation technology. Transportation technology is rapidly, rapidly moving away from technologies that CARB endorses, like buses.
The problem, though, is that even with higher electric car sales, you still have so many fossil fuel powered cars that are going to be on the road for decades to come, just because of how long cars last and the price disadvantage of buying a new vehicle. So how do you possibly meet this, even with incentives for people to buy electric, when gas-powered cars are going to continue to be cheaper?
Well, and that's a very good issue, and it's one that, frankly, CARB has been advised on. NextGen, which is run by Tom Steyer, a climate champion, has confirmed that lower-income people and people in rural communities simply lack any kind of practical access to transportation solutions that work. And for that reason has strongly promoted, and CARB has partly endorsed, getting more electric cars and more electric car infrastructure incentives into lower income communities. Getting cleaner cars is indeed what's required. Getting older polluting cars off the road, again, is a tool that we've used successfully in the context of the Clean Air Act without depriving people of the ability to get to work. The shortest distance out of poverty, according to a RAND report, Brookings Institute report, shortest distance out of poverty is for a family to own a car. And we have 6,000 more jobs, 6,000 times more jobs accessible to drivers in the Los Angeles region than are accessible to people taking public.
All right. We're talking with Attorney Jennifer Hernandez, also with us, Chanel Fletcher of Climate Plan. I welcome your calls. I'd like to hear from you. We invited the State Air Resources Board to join us in conversation, and they declined. Their report argues that the only way to meet the 2030 greenhouse gas emission standards put in place by the state legislature is by building more in urban areas, that that's what's going to get people out of their cars. My question for you is, do you think that that's really true? For example, with some of the, you know, the transit village development, people still have their cars. They do not every day necessarily take light rail or public transportation, but they like living in the walkable area because that's where the restaurants, the shopping is. It's a cool place to live. Not necessarily so they can take light rail or the train every day. So my question for you is, do you agree with CARB? Do you think that that is what's going to significantly cut people getting in their cars and driving or not? 866-893-KPCC, 866-893-5722, or the AirTalk page, kpcc.org. Also, what do you think of Chanel Fletcher, her suggestion that if people just drove a couple miles less a day on average, that would enable the standard to be met? 866-893-KPCC. Do you think it's feasible for the state to be able to meet the threshold that way? Ms. Fletcher, your response to what Ms. Hernandez was saying about lower-income Californians being the ones disproportionately hurt by CARB's recommendations?
I think the one thing that I think Jennifer and I both agree on is that particularly when you're looking at lower-income Californians, but also those in rural areas, is that they're the ones that are the most hurt by the lack of transportation options. And I think that's something that we feel strongly about as well. I think what I would probably say is that electric vehicles are part of the solution. I think we've seen the state and we've seen CARB put a lot of energy and rebates into making these cars more affordable. But as you pointed out, we're still seeing, I think, a number of fossil fuel cars being sold. And I think this goes back to kind of one of our kind of big kind of takeaways from this report and our work, which is that we really want to see a shift away from funding going to roads and highways to going to more climate-friendly transportation. Climate-friendly transportation is looking at investments in transit, walking, bicycling, but also things like jump bikes or like bike share. I think giving people different options, both in rural communities and in urban communities, and so for rural communities, that could even be van pools, making sure that they have those options in place are a key thing. And I think when we have a system that we have where we set up where you spent like 60 years building out this impressive highway and road system, it does take time to dismantle that. And this report, in our opinion, is really a call to action for us to start thinking about how do we shift away from giving people the only option of cars and actually giving them more options to get around and travel.
What's ironic, though, is that in Los Angeles County, at least, there are more public transit options now that by far than there have ever been. And yet public transit usage is decreasing. So as more opportunities are there, fewer people are using it because gasoline is still comparatively low to purchase. Used cars are historically low to purchase. And so the advantages of being able to go directly point to point are so great that even, you know, people making minimum wage are able to buy a used car, keep gas in it, and use it to get to work. How do you convince, you know, someone to take public transit when it's less convenient, when they can afford to use a car?
Exactly. And that, I think, and that's that UCLA study that did that work. And I think that's something that we've seen. And we're looking at about 15 years of that kind of investment in Los Angeles County around public transit. And I think our biggest challenge is that 15 years compared to 60 years makes it still really inconvenient. And I think the hardest thing about the work that we're doing is that it will take time. And I think that people, you know, it's hard to understand that, but it's true, is that we're competing against, like we said, like you just said, it's so much easier, it's cheaper to get in this car. And I think what we're trying to do is say, how many more options can we give people so we can start to see that shift happen? And I think we are seeing it, definitely not to the level that we want to, but it is happening and it is occurring. And so I think our talking point is still matching and making sure that we're providing those options and giving people that investment level, and we believe that we will see that shift in time.
FedUp writes on the AirTalk page, of course we're not on track. The goals were set artificially beyond reason, and the fires undid all the progress. Beside the building codes mandate unnecessarily pointless air conditioning that only heats the exterior air, and goes on to make a number of other critiques. Joaquin writes on the page, public transit usage has fallen because bus service is slower and less consistent. The average speed of LA Metro buses has fallen by 2 miles an hour. We need bus-only lanes. You can share your comments on the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. We'll continue our conversation with our guests in just 1 minute. Right now on Air Talk, the State Air Resources Board, its recommendations that California implement more urban housing development policies to get people closer to where they work, to cut down on the miles driven per capita by Californians. Those miles have been going up. More people have been buying cars. And have continued to commute, in many cases, longer distances to have affordable housing or to have properties that are larger than they would have if they lived in the city. For some working class families, the idea of being able to rent or purchase a house in an outlying community to raise children there makes it worth it to them to make a very long commute to go into where their jobs are. But I'd like to hear from you what you think of the State Air Resources Board recommendation. Would that really enable to meet the state to meet these ambitious greenhouse gas emission goals by 2030? 866-893-KPCC. Anthony in the Fairfax District, welcome.
Hi there. I've lived in neighborhoods all over Los Angeles and currently live in Fairfax, one of the most dense neighborhoods in L.A., and I can definitely say that living in a dense neighborhood has reduced the amount of driving I do. It's just I can walk to almost everything I need to do except for work. And so I agree with the recommendation. I think we should be building more in more dense ways. I just don't think it should necessarily be mandated by the government, but I think we should make it a lot easier and encourage more densely populated development.
Now, in Los Angeles currently, whenever there's an urban development that's created, it's typically higher income people that move in. It's not working class people who are commuting long distances. It's people looking for an urban experience. Do you see that having a trickle-down effect on people who are doing the longest commutes?
Well, I don't claim to be an expert economist, but I think increasing the supply generally improves the situation for everyone. In some neighborhoods where there's gentrification happening, I think high-end development can, you know, increase prices and price people out. But if we're talking about just increasing the supply and generally, you know, in neighborhoods around the city, I think that's going to have a positive effect on everybody.
All right. Appreciate it, Anthony. Let's talk next with Alex joining us from Culver City. Alex, your thoughts about the CARB report.
Yes, sir. Any sort of policy that is going to reduce commutes for middle-class Americans will primarily have to be centered around two things. As that gentleman said, zoning law and taxes, you need to create incentives for people to increase the supply. And a trickle down, saying that it's a trickle down just kind of makes it sound like you don't really understand what the economy is. It's not a trickle-down effect. It's more of like a money multiplier. So as $1 is spent in the private sector, it kind of ripples through the economy, almost like a lake or an ocean. Trickle-down kind of just makes it gears the conversation towards like a class discussion, even though we're supposed to be talking about how to benefit all Americans.
Well, I think there's the theory, though, that if you create more housing, even if higher income people move into those new units, that over time has an effect, allowing people to get into entry-level housing that's freed up as people move up the housing chain, so to speak. So there is a class dimension to it, at least as some argue. So my question is, do you think as more new housing is created for urban dwellers, even if those are higher income people, that frees up older, less desirable units for lower income people?
Oh, absolutely. And that's what you've seen, especially when you start moving around the zoning laws in order to allow people to build higher, as well as kind of make it more efficient to keep more people in a specific area. You also get a larger tax pool, which means that your schools, any public utilities that you're going to be getting from these people who are generating more income is going to affect, like, the nearby area, you know, in terms of transit, in terms of housing prices, and in terms of your tax, like, pool.
All right, Alex, appreciate the call. Ray in Irvine, you're on Air Talk.
Yeah, good morning to you. I wanted to say that I'm a former traffic engineer, and I worked in this field for many, many years. And, you know, it's a known fact, yet everyone engages in this. It's a losing battle to add more supply of, say, highway miles, because by the time a highway mile is constructed and ready for use, urban development, residential development preempts it, and that supply, quote-unquote supply, is already exhausted by the development that moves in. And I wanted to say that I completely agree with your point about decentralizing our employment centers. Because until that happens, we're going to have these deep employment centers like L.A. or parts of Orange County, and then we're going to have all these satellite residential centers. And as people get priced out of nearby satellite residential centers, they move farther and farther away, but the employment has stayed where it was. And to that point, L.A., I believe, was vying to be Amazon's H2Q. And that would have been a blessing and a curse, I think. Sure, it would have deepened their tax revenue base, but really would have dealt a death blow to quality of life and really air quality in L.A., which L.A. may never catch up.
Ray, I appreciate your call. Thank you for being with us. Kathy in Malibu says it'd be good to have incentives for people to carpool to work. I travel long distance, work in San Gabriel, and they have incentives for us to take vanpools. Actually, I believe she lives in San Gabriel, works in Malibu. Says it's beneficial because it reduces the number of people that are driving alone. Mike in downtown Los Angeles said, I moved downtown a couple of years ago, bought a bike, been riding to work since then, but there's still a problem of air quality in the center of the city. That has to be addressed if people are going to be biking or going to be walking long distances. You can share your comments on the Air Talk page, kpecc.org, and let us know what you think. Chanel Fletcher of Climate Plan, just in closing, what do you think is realistic to expect out of the State Air Resources Board report?
And realistic to expect, I think, agencies to do, or realistic in terms of actions to expect to see kind of happen.
Yeah, whether it's implementing policies or incentives, what do you think realistically comes out of this to go after the emissions?
I think the biggest thing is really going to be, and I'm going to hammer this home again, is that transportation funding and looking at where it's going and making sure that it's going to help us meet our climate goals. And I think that's something that we at Climate Plan are pretty fired up about. And I think this report helps to give us the data that we need to start working closely with agencies like Caltrans and other agencies to say we need to start shifting our funds and giving cities and counties the resources to continue, I think, the investment in public transportation so that we can start seeing the shifts that we need.
I want to thank you for being with us. Chanel Fletcher of the nonprofit Climate Action. She's director of the organization. Jennifer Hernandez, land use and environmental attorney, and she's representing a civil rights group that has filed a lawsuit against the State Air Resources Board, claiming that CARB's move into housing policy violates state and federal civil rights laws. You can share your comments on the State Air Resources Board report on the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Sadie tweets at AirTalk, how are we supposed to ride our bikes to get groceries for the week for a family? Or am I supposed to go every day? I don't have time for that. I'd like to see all the Sacramento politicians who voted for this emission standard try to live their lives that way. Again, you can share your comments on the AirTalk page. Coming up, our focus on preparations for the rain coming later today to the burn areas of Southern California. A couple of major areas for concern because of recent fires. One, the Holy Fire that burned in the Cleveland National Forest above the Lake Elsinore area affected the county intersection of Orange and Riverside counties. Also, of course, the Woolsey Fire, which just recently was extinguished. We begin with the Holy Fire and concerns about potential mudslides with Fernando Herrera, captain with CAL FIRE in Riverside. Thank you so much, Captain Herrera, for joining us. What sort of preparations are being put in place for the areas below the Holy Fire burn area?
Well, since the Holy Fire ended, you know, we've been working really hard on trying to get a plan together for this winter, especially with all the storms coming. So for this particular storm, we've initiated our operations plans, which basically means that well ahead of time, the city itself, the city of Lake Elsinore, as well as the county, has been working really hard on reinforcing a lot of the culverts, the drains throughout the at-risk areas where all the canyons potentially could have mud flows, severe flooding, et cetera. We also been proactive in providing a lot of sand in all the local fire stations as well as City Hall. A lot of the barricades have been put in place in a lot of the areas that are concerned that would be at risk. The work continues today. Today we have a lot of those county resources, again, reinforcing a lot of those areas, a lot of those culverts, a lot of those drainages, and making sure that in the event that we do have any significant rain that potentially could have impacts as like a mud flow or debris flow, that a lot of those drainages that were built in will have the capacity to handle that flow and be able to divert some of it and some of the surrounding housing tracks around the at-risk area.
Are you recommending evacuation for some of the residents who are directly beneath the burn area?
Well, as of Monday, we put an alert through our reverse 911 system, basically alerting folks to get ready. Then yesterday we put in another alert, basically.
Fernando Herrera, you there? Okay, I guess we lost him. We'll try and get him back. Fernando Herrera with CAL FIRE in Riverside. Just to give you an update where things stood as of late yesterday, with the possibility of thunderstorms for the Holy Fire burn area, there are some of the smaller canyons that are nearby where people are being told that they can evacuate. It's a voluntary evacuation zone. So we just want to find out whether that's still in place for Amoros, Albert Hill, Glen Ivy, the A area there, Horse Thief A area, Eden, Grace, Laguna A area, and some of the other communities that are around there. Also want to find out about Highway 74, which is a major commuting road between the Lake Elsinore area and South Orange County, if there's any potential there that Highway 74 would be affected. So we hope to get him back. But meanwhile, let's check in on Malibu and the Woolsey Fire area there. Lou Lamont, who's Malibu City Council member, joins us. Councilman, thank you so much. What sort of prep is going on in Malibu?
Good morning. Well, at this particular point in time, it seems the National Weather Service and NOAA are not predicting heavy rains, but they are predicting long-term rains. It could be as long as 12 hours. And what we're doing to work with that is we're working with our Public Works Department, as well as the L.A. County Public Works Department and the Fire Department, to pre-position equipment and personnel throughout all the burn areas where it's necessary. So that's the first step that we're taking. We want to be prepared for whatever's going to happen, and we're monitoring it constantly.
All right. And what sort of mitigations, as you've had such a short period of time here, any sorts of barriers you've been able to get into some of the areas most affected?
Our public works department has worked with a lot of the stuff. It's also cleaning in a lot of, you know, drains that are there now and had been clogged through the fire. So a lot of that has been going on already. But primarily, we just want to be prepared in the areas where it could possibly happen. And that's why we're pre-positioning all this equipment. We will be continuing this with the equipment and the personnel 24 hours a day until this situation is over.
All right. I want to thank you, Councilman, as always. Appreciate it very much. And we send our best to Malibu.
Thank you.
Malibu City Council Member Lou Lamont. We have CAL FIRE Riverside Captain Fernando Herrera back with us. Captain, when we lost connection, you were just describing the voluntary evacuations yesterday. Some were put in place. Are those still in force today?
Yes, correct. Those are voluntary evacuations that are in place today. We're monitoring the weather. Based on the latest forecast that we get, we'll make a determination later on whether or not we need to extend that to a mandatory evacuation. We've also pre-positioned equipment from public safety side, law enforcement, fire department, and other county agencies here in Lake Elsinore in the event that we have a major storm that could impact the at-risk areas with mud flows, debris flows, extensive flooding. We do have resources pre-positioned throughout the area to respond to do any type of search and rescue or any type of flooding assistance if that need arises. So we're being very proactive. Today is a big day. We're planning for a lot of movement throughout the local county as well as other agencies coming in to support our mission here. And obviously, we want to err in the side of safety. We take this very seriously. We want the folks to heed to the warnings that we're giving. And if we decide that we're going to put on a mandatory evacuation, then folks need to respect that and be able to immediately, follow the directions given by the law enforcement and fire department.
Quick, almost out of time, but quick question for you. The fire, the Holy Fire burned up to Ortega Highway near Lookout Roadhouse there. And I'm trying to recall, there may be a downhill slope so that the highway wouldn't be threatened. But do you know if Highway 74, there's any potential for mudslides on the road there?
Not at this point. We've been in contact with Caltrans. They're monitoring those sites. They will continue to have personnel up there monitoring. If at any point that highway itself is impacted, then obviously we would have road closures that Caltrans and CHP will work on.
But which would
right
be a mess.
That particular corridor is open.
All right, that's a mess because major commuting corridor between Southern Orange County and Southwest Riverside County. Thank you so much, Captain. We appreciate your being with us. That's Fernando Herrera of CAL FIRE Riverside. Coming up, your favorite television animated series of your youth. This in the wake of yesterday's death of Steven Hillenburg, the man who created SpongeBob SquarePants, a beloved series and with multi-generational appeal. I'd like to hear from you. The animated series that maybe had multi-generational appeal in your household, 866-893-KPCC or the AirTalk page, kpcc.org. And after Hetty does her local newscast, I'm going to spill the beans about her being an animation star. That's coming right up. Yesterday, we lost a great creator in Steven Hillenburg, the man who went from being a marine biologist to going to CalArts when he decided he wanted to pursue animation and created the indelible character of SpongeBob SquarePants. Extremely popular television animated series and, of course, a couple feature films that followed as well. And one of the great things about SpongeBob, like the best of TV animation, is it worked in multiple generations. So I could watch it with our son growing up, laugh every bit as hard as he did. Well, let's remember one of the most famous episodes, Graveyard Shift. Squidward tries to scare SpongeBob by telling him the ghost story of a fry cook who now has a spatula for a hand called the Hash Slinging Slasher.
The Slash Bringing Hasher?
The Hash Slinging Slasher.
The Sash Ringing, the Trash Singing, Mash Flinging, the Flash Springing, Ringing, the Crash Dinging.
SpongeBob SquarePants. And of course, for those of us that are baby boomers, you got to remember The Adventures of Rocky and Bullwinkle and Friends first aired in 1959, only ran until 1964, but it seems like it's been in syndication ever since.
Well, Rocky and Bullwinkle really started something just by trying to bake a cake. For instead of dessert, they wound up with an explosive that blew their stove clean to the moon. The nation was astounded.
That cake batter must be a revolutionary rocket fuel.
Grandma called it fudge cake.
Bullwinkle was immediately made director of guided missiles, and he and Rocky set out to duplicate the recipe, which unfortunately had been torn in half by the explosion. But apparently not everybody wanted them to succeed, for when we left them last time, a scaly green hand was raising a sinister weapon and pointing it right at their heads.
Hokey smoke, Bullwinkle! Look there!
Now, Kidney?
Not now, Cloyd.
Why not? I haven't scrooched anybody since we've been here.
What are they, Rocky?
I don't know. I've never seen anything like them.
Maybe they're congressmen.
Rocky and Bullwinkle, June Foray, the great voice there, longtime friend of Air Talk and listener to the program, best known for Rocky the Squirrel, but did many other voices. And of course, that's William Conrad, who was a radio star, played Matt Dillon on Gunsmoke before the television Gunsmoke, and went on to be a star in the TV series Cannon. With us, animation authority Charles Solomon, who's one of our Film Week critics, of course. Charles, SpongeBob, an indelible animated series. Kids are going to be watching that for decades.
Sure. I mean, it's enormously popular. There have been two features. I don't know how many episodes. There was a musical.
Still on Broadway. It's hugely successful.
Yeah, it's very popular. One, I think, for production design, a Tony. But another thing I think we should mention is that Hillenburg was not only an extraordinarily successful creator, he was an extremely nice man. He was gentle. He was kind. He was well-loved as well as well-respected, which cannot be said of, you know, many important figures in Hollywood.
So a tremendous loss, but what an incredible contribution. One of the things I love about Steven Hillenburg's story is that he worked as a marine biologist before he became an animator. So he merged his two interests.
Yeah, I suspect that's where he got the idea for SpongeBob. And I've seen some early sketches when he was still called, I think, Sponge Boy. But he even taught marine biology down here. He had gone to school up north, I think, in Washington. But, you know, that's where your ideas come from. You look in, as Chuck Jones always said, he would look in the mirror, and that's where he got the inspiration for his characters. So if he was looking at sponges and coral and algae all day, you would think had an animator's spirit, that's where you would get the idea for a sponge character.
I'd love to hear from you as an Air Talk listener, particularly animation, which has multi-generational appeal. For me growing up, it wasn't just Rocky and Bullwinkle. It was the great Warner Brothers cartoons, which I'd watch my parents. We'd laugh because they're multiple generation references. What for you are your favorites? 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722, or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Well, I mentioned that our son, we'd watch SpongeBob with him, but I have to say, one of my all-time favorites, the great Phineas and Ferb, the Disney TV series where probably seen 80% of the episodes over the years.
Wow.
The co-creator of Phineas and Ferb, Dan Bovenmeyer, joining us. Dan, thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, thanks. It's a sad time in animation,
It was a very sad thing to hear yesterday, and it hit us a lot of us very hard, because Steve was always just the greatest guy, and Vince Waller said that he always steered his rudder towards good, and I think that, you know, he left the world a better place than it was when he got here.
You worked with him as director on the series, what, three seasons of the show?
I was on for one season of that show. I was on for five seasons with him on Rocco's Modern Life, where we all sort of met. That was sort of all of our first gigs in animation. And then I was on Family Guy, and then it got canceled, and I came over for a season of SpongeBob, and then it got picked back up, and so I went back over. I directed the clip that you played, the graveyard shift.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
And so, Dan, you know, talk about animation that appeals to the parents as well as the kids, because with Phineas, you know, that's throughout. You're making all kinds of references that are going to connect with multiple generations. How intentional is that?
Well, including they did a brilliant spoof of Star Wars with Phineas and Ferb that both made fun of Star Wars and kept the characters completely true to themselves.
we just sort of, you know, in the Star Wars special, we did sort of a Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are dead version where our characters were having a parallel adventure to the Star Wars characters. It was always very intentional. In the first season of Phineas, there were times where the executives would say, well, okay, that's a funny joke, but is our audience even going to get it? And I would say, you know, I don't care, because there's another joke coming for the kids in 5 seconds. I guarantee you the we're aiming at the adults in the room, because the adults have to watch these shows with their kids. And I remember watching Bugs Bunny with my dad and him laughing at different things that I laughed at. And then 10 years later, I'd watch it and I'd laugh at the things that he laughed at. It helps things become a family viewing in a way that's felt like was disappearing when we were doing Phineas, even when we were doing SpongeBob. It was something that every age group in a household generally had their own TV, and we felt like nobody was getting back together and watching TV, so we wanted to do something that everybody would watch together.
Well, yeah. That's something that Bill Scott talked about for Rocky and Bullwinkle, that it was very deliberately written on three levels, one for little kids, one for older kids, and one for adults.
And that's a huge challenge. We'll continue with Dan Povenmeier, co-creator of the Disney TV series Phineas and Ferb. He also worked five seasons as director of SpongeBob SquarePants with Stephen Hillenburg, who died yesterday of complications from ALS. Charles Solomon, animation expert, Film Week critic with us. We'll be back in 1 minute on Air Talk. Ernie messages the Air Talk Facebook page. I grew up in the 70s and I loved classic Warner Brothers cartoons, Tom and Jerry cartoons. He preferred that to the Hanna-Barbera cartoons that were so prevalent for many of us growing up with the more limited animation. Kofefi Le Pew tweets at Air Talk, Kimba the White Lion, as relevant today as it was then. That was a Japanese series.
Yeah, that was Tezuka. That was Osamu Tezuka, and it was only shown here in syndication.
I remember it wasn't terrible when I was little.
Yeah, it wasn't a huge hit here.
Is that the guy who did Astro Boy?
Yes.
And Gigantor?
I'm not sure about Gigantor, but he did do Astro Boy.
Okay.
And then Kimba was his second big series.
All right. Let's talk with Ernesto in Westwood. Ernesto, your memory of your favorite animated show from childhood.
So I love SpongeBob, but I just wanted to really highlight the fact that SpongeBob also has a really huge presence on the internet, which is why I think the loss of, you know, the creator is so impactful right now. It's because on Twitter, on all of these different websites, you really see these snapshots of episodes that you remember, and then people putting a meme on it or empathizing with, you know, not only SpongeBob, but Squidward. You know, as we grew up, we became more, you know, I would say more Squidward-like than SpongeBob's, you know, optimism, and more like, you know, day-in, day-out Squidward kind of vibe.
Ernesto, I'm so glad you brought this up, because for so many people, it's through the SpongeBob memes that are online that they remember the show and it lives on. And let me go back to Dan Povenmire, because that's something, when you're creating those shows, you're probably not even thinking about the ways it's going to be reused in the future.
No, it's, you know, it was good to start making cartoons when the internet was starting, and sort of because it sort of gave you an audience reaction, which you didn't, you know, you used to be, you make TV, you sort of send it out into the ether and you get ratings, and that was the only way you could tell. But suddenly, you know, it's like, oh, this scene is really taking off because people are using it for memes. People are using, they're putting it on YouTube and you know, repeating one scene for 4 hours, you know, on a loop in the internet. That kind of stuff gives you an idea of what's connecting with people, and it was a good time to start making cartoons.
Helen writes on the AirTalk page, "I love SpongeBob SquarePants. I started watching it when I was in elementary school. I still watch it to this day when it's on. Whenever I watch it, my dad walk by, we'd start singing the theme song. Whenever I want to relax, I watch cartoons and anime like Powerpuff Girls, The Grim Adventures of Billy and Mandy, Codename Kids Next Door, The Simpsons, Naruto, Yuri on Ice, Attack on Titan, and many more. Animation rocks." That's Helen, right? Sounds like, yeah.
It does, doesn't it?
Yeah, you love Helen, Charles, I'm sure. Julia writes on the page, "I love spending my Saturday mornings watching cartoons with my siblings. My favorite was definitely the Transformers, but we also enjoyed quirky, obscure shows like Bucky O'Hare and the Toad Wars, a space adventure in a parallel universe fronted by a green rabbit who captains a ship called the Righteous Indignation." That's Julia writing on the AirTalk page. Belinda writes simply, "Animaniacs." All right. You can put your posting of your favorite animation on the AirTalk page. Jeffrey in Beverly Hills, your favorite memory of childhood cartoons.
Yes, the cartoons that were hosted by Tom Hatton, I believe on KTTV, Channel
yes.
5, were mainly from the 1930s. And which I wouldn't otherwise have been exposed to. And some of them were multi-generational. I remember a Betty Boop with live inserts of Cab Calloway singing Minnie the Mooter, which children wouldn't appreciate on the same level as an adult. But others were songs from the 1930s that found their way into Busby Berkeley musicals. They were quite extraordinary.
Charles, do you want to comment?
Yeah, well, that was when the Warner Brothers cartoons were starting. They initially had to include a song from Warner Brothers Publishing in every cartoon.
Which is why it was called Looney Tunes.
It was a play. It was off Silly Symphonies of Disney's. Yeah. But they did, for example, Shuffle Off the Buffalo takes the song from 42nd Street and gives it some different words and has cartoon characters frolicking to it.
Yeah. Well, you know, songs, I think, are the closest thing you get to immortality in cartoons, because I can sing Sugar, ba-da-da-da-bum-bum.
The Archies, yeah.
The plot line from the Archies. That's why in SpongeBob and Rocco and Phineas and Ferb, we always tried to write songs for things. So I wrote a song for SpongeBob called the Campfire Song, and I just recently saw a video of some garage band playing a version of that song.
You can also probably sing the overture from The Barber of Seville with What Would You Want with a Rabbit?
Yeah, and remember Josie and the Pussycats, which was all built around a musical group. Alexander tweets at Air Talk, "I wasn't introduced to one of my favorite animated series until I was in my 20s, but I know many generations who enjoy Avatar The Last Airbender, something I love. I can't wait to share it with my son when he's old enough." Charles, important just to mention, we think of so much of this American-created, but Japanese animation, huge.
Yes, and that's what a lot of kids are watching now. You mentioned Naruto and Yuri on Ice. It's new material, it's different material, but it's still animated and it still crosses boundaries the same way.
All right. Dan Povenmire, I want to thank you for being with us and sharing your memories of Steve Hillenburg and also your time on SpongeBob SquarePants. Appreciate it. Dan Povenmire, the co-creator of the Disney TV series Phineas and Ferb, and Charles Solomon. Charles, always a pleasure. We'll have you with us soon on Film Week. All right. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. I'll tell you what's to come in the second hour in just a minute. It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us this morning. I'm just going to take something head on out of the gate. You might think it's not the most interesting thing to hear about the liability of privately owned utility companies for huge and deadly wildfires, but over the course of the next hour, as we drill down layer after layer after layer, I think you're going to find this one of the most important and fascinating stories that we could take on. It's about how that issue of liability affects taxpayers, affects pension funds, and affects the future of public safety here in the Golden State. I begin with KPECC infrastructure correspondent Sharon McNary. You've heard her reporting in depth on the ramifications of the massive fires over the past few years here in California that have taken a huge toll in lives and in property, and determining who is responsible for it. Sharon, thank you for joining us.
Appreciate it.
So the issue here is some of these massive fires that we've had, and this includes the potential of the Camp Fire, the deadliest in California history, that a privately held utility might be found legally responsible and financially responsible. Why does this matter?
Well, it matters because if you're a customer of one of these big utilities, be it PG&E, Southern California Edison, San Diego Gas and Electric, you could end up paying the cost of the damages that are not covered by insurers if the utility's equipment caused the fire. You, the customer. Now, if there's negligence in how they maintained the wires, then you might be off the hook. In that case, the PUC could tell the utility, the California Public Utilities Commission could tell the utility, hey, this has to come out of your earnings, your shareholders.
You can't pass this on to your customers.
And that happened last year when the California Public Utilities Commission told San Diego Gas and Electric from a 2007 fire, your insurers paid $2 billion worth of costs, but you still owe $380-something million, you may not pass that on to your customers. And that set off, and it would be paid by your shareholders. And that set off a whole series of legislative events that almost, you know, changed how damages are paid after these big fires.
Sharon, who makes the determination as to whether if it's believed the source of a fire is equipment operated by a private utility, how is the determination made whether that's just sort of unanticipated, you know, the transformer malfunctions or a wire that had been inspected, you know, fails because of high winds, couldn't be anticipated versus a company shirking its responsibility to do preventive maintenance?
The California Public Utilities Commission has an entity called the Safety Division, and they have investigators who will order the utilities that they regulate to capture all of the failed power poles and the wires and the exploded transformers near the start of the fire. They also and they put them in storage. Storage so secure that even the CEO of Southern California Edison was not able to get his investigators into the PUC warehouse where the stuff that might have caused the start of the Thomas Fire last year was being stored. So it's very secure. They also order up all the internal communications, all the 911 calls. And so there's an investigation. So Cal Fire, the local fire authority, will say what it thought caused the fire. And then the Public Utilities Commission does its own investigation. And as part of that, they'll come up with a determination, and it's not a public process until it's over with, as to whether the utility caused the fire and whether there was negligence involved.
Let me bring into the conversation, along with our own Sharon McNary, Mike Moeller, who's with Cal Fire, California Department of Forestry and Fire Protection. Cal Fire is in the process of investigating the Camp Fire, which, of course, was just extinguished very, very recently, deadliest fire in California history. So obviously, you know, we can't talk about that investigation because it's going on right now. But Mike Mohler, can you talk a bit about how you determine the liability in a major fire?
No, absolutely. And just for your listeners, so anytime we have a any type of fire response, immediately upon the 911 call, we dispatch investigators to respond to that scene. And we investigate several hundred fires a year across the state. But without going too deep into our investigatory techniques, you know, it's a very time-consuming, very thorough process where we go out, find what we would consider the point of origin or where we think the fire originated at, and then we move out from that to see, was it, you know, 97% of all fires are caused by humans, not necessarily negligent, but there's also other causes. But it's a very thorough, methodical process, including some points that we actually send evidence out to get testing, what we call destructive testing, to see if maybe there was a malfunction of some sort. And then under the Public Resources Code, our investigators look and see if there is violations, then we'll forward it to the proper authorities for what county it's in. Or if we determine that there are no violations, then no, then we do not move forward. But we work very closely with the CPUC and the utility companies. Really, our obligation is to the citizens of California to come out with what we consider the cause of every fire.
Do the tools that you use, have they developed in recent years to where you have a higher degree of confidence in your determination about the cause of a fire, or are the techniques pretty much the same as were used 20 years ago?
No, absolutely. Technology definitely plays a major role, not only just in infrared and fire detection systems that you see out through across the state where we can use, you know, time-lapse cameras, but also just on the ground. Our investigators, not just Cal Fire, but working with our local, state, and federal law enforcement partners, have access to other technologies that have definitely advanced our techniques and continue to advance. There's not a day in public safety that we don't look to train and improve on all techniques. But yes, it has definitely improved over the past decade.
And what sorts of specialists did you have working on this? Are they people who this is all they do, is investigate the ignition of fires?
No, absolutely. In fact, Cal Fire is one of the only agencies in the United States. We actually have our investigators are actually California law, or actually peace officers, law enforcement officers that go through a full law enforcement academy, and then including specialized training for cause and determination of fires. So, and that is their focus. That is their only job, including the enforcement of forestry and fire laws. Their specialty is fire investigation.
Now, is it at the Cal Fire level where your investigators are determining potential negligence on the part of the utility, or does that come in an additional layer once Cal Fire investigators turn over their report of where they think it started?
No, it does. That does fall into part of it. Again, under enforcing the Public Resources Code, there is a part in there that can show that maybe there was negligence, and it doesn't necessarily have to be a utility company. It could be a citizen doing something wrong place, wrong time that we see negligence. But in addition to that, when we make a determination that there was some type of a violation, we work very closely with the local district attorney's office to see where that is going to move forward and support them with all of our reports and findings.
And at what point does Cal Fire or another state agency get access to the maintenance records of the equipment in the area where the fire started?
Well, we work, again, very closely with all utility companies, understanding that they also want, the report information that when we request it, our investigators go through the process with the utility company and are able to view if it is a piece of equipment or a pole, are allowed access or any type of information from the utility, access is provided to our investigators.
We're talking with Cal Fire's Mike Mohler. He's Deputy Director of Communications. Cal Fire is in the process of investigating the Camp Fire. Any sense of the timeline to do that investigation? I mean, it's so massive. I don't know if you're just focused on the area where the fire started, or whether it takes covering, huge square miles to get a handle on this.
Yeah, no, and that is a great point. So when we see these large, well, now, unfortunately, we're used to these mega fires, there's a lot of ground to cover. Hundreds and hundreds of personnel investigative hours have to go into these. Our obligation is to the public. It really is, to the citizens of California, to determine cause and origin of these fires, not only just for for the understanding, but for also closure for a lot of people that who have, you know, have lost their homes or loved ones. But these investigations, we never put a timeline on them. We don't have the opportunity to be 70% right. When we release a cause under CAL FIRE, we have the obligation to be 100% right. So these can take several months, if not up to a year, if not longer, because there is so much ground to cover. There's so many evidence things that we have to look at. So never a timeline, but you can guarantee you these are going to take several months, if not longer.
Mike Mohler with us of CAL FIRE. Sharon, I know in some of the earlier ones that CAL FIRE's investigated, it's taken many months.
We're still waiting for the outcome of the Thomas Fire, which started almost a year ago. I think it was December 4th or December 5th. I mean, it just feels like a very, very long time for the public to wait to know what happened. And in the Thomas Fire, there were supposedly two different ignition points, one of which has been the focus of whether it was caused by utility equipment.
Where was that one?
Konigstein Road out in Santa Paula. And then a second ignition point on Anloff Canyon Road, which to me, I have less information about that one.
And that's Southern California Edison
that's
area.
That's Edison territory,
where
yeah.
their lines go through.
Yeah.
All right. Sharon McNary, KPCC infrastructure reporter with us. We invited a representative of PG&E to join us. They declined to take part, but we're pleased to have the president and CEO of Edison International, parent company of SoCal Edison, Pedro Pizarro. We should mention that SoCal Edison is an underwriter of KPCC. Mr. Pizarro, thank you for being with us.
Larry, thanks so much for having me here.
So in this case, let's go back to the Thomas Fire. It's nearly a year ago. So in a case like this, what are you looking at to determine what your exposure potentially is for that fire?
Well, first and foremost, you know, we're part of these communities, so our hearts go out to everybody impacted by all of these catastrophic events in California. In an event like Thomas, we cooperate with CAL FIRE and other agencies that investigate. I think Sharon McNary mentioned the CPUC Safety and Enforcement Division earlier. So we make sure that we're cooperating fully with all the agencies looking at that. We also do our own review, as you can imagine, and because as the operator of a utility that 15 million residents rely on across 50,000 square miles, and we recognize that we need to do everything we can to operate a safe and reliable system. So 1.5 million poles out there, this is a significant, you know, system that we have to monitor. In a case of a fire, we, you know, want to know whether our equipment may have been a contributing cause of a fire. And so in the case of the Thomas Fire, as I think Sharon shared, we did disclose recently to the community and to our investors that we are aware of at least two different points of origin. And while we're still waiting for CAL FIRE's investigation to be completed, we understand that could take some time, we had sufficient evidence for the Konigstein site that we knew that our equipment was involved. We don't know why that happened. We're still reviewing what the cause of that would have been.
And you don't have access to that equipment at that point. This point, is that in state custody?
There is some equipment that we do not have access to that is still in CAL FIRE's possession. We expect that when their investigation progresses, we may get access to that. So that's partly why we really can't determine at this point whether this was an accident that happened or something out of our control, or whether it's something where we would have had, you know, more direct responsibility.
One of the issues, and this came up with the Camp Fire, where PG&E had put out notice to some of the residents that their electricity may be shut off because of weather conditions that they were worried would be conducive to the start of a fire. They didn't cut off the power
proactively because they said it didn't reach that threshold. But then there was also the issue that it's thought the potential for where the fire started was the longer distance transmission lines, not the local service lines that would have been cut off. Can you briefly speak to that point? If with the transmission lines that go long distance, is there any way that you could shut those down because of weather conditions, or would it only be local transmission lines?
Well, we also have a public safety power shutoff program where we do, have criteria that we look at that are very, location by location, and they look at things like the particular topography, the needs of the community, safety factors like wind speed and relative humidity and the like. But those are typically for distribution lines because we do control directly the operation of those. With higher voltage transmission lines, those are under the operational control of the California Independent System Operator. Those typically, at least in our program, I can only speak for Edison's programs, we have not included those in the public safety power shutoff program. We have tended to see those lines as having much wider setback areas. They're different from the distribution poles that are so ubiquitous where we have an obligation to make sure we have infrastructure everywhere. I think a difference there is our ability to make those decisions, obviously in consultation with various entities, but ultimately our distribution operation centers have operational control of those lines. In the current case of transmission lines, those
okay.
are operated by a California Independent System Operator.
We're talking with the president and CEO of the parent company of SoCal Edison. It's Edison International, Pedro Pizarro with us, KPCC infrastructure correspondent Sharon McNary, who herself is an authority on this, reporting on all the permutations of potential exposure financially, private utility companies in these terrible fires we've had recently in California. Coming up, California Assemblymember Chris Holden will be talking with us about a bill he's introducing in January, the upcoming legislative session that would deal with liability for the private power suppliers. You're listening to Air Talk on KPCC. Back in 1 minute. Good to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. We're spending the entire hour focused on the liability of private electricity providers when we have massive fires in California. The question is, who should pay? Under what circumstances? Should it be the shareholders in the private utilities? Should the companies be able to pass on all or part of the expenses to ratepayers? That's under the control of California Public Utilities Commission. What are the implications if a private utility goes through serious financial reverses because of huge liabilities? What are the public consequences of that, not just to shareholders? With us is Chris Holden, who's Democratic member of the California Assembly. Number of years back, Chris and I actually co-hosted a program on Pasadena City Television Channel KPAS. Assemblyman, good to talk with you again.
Larry, it's good to be with you again.
Thanks. Well, let's talk about the bill you're introducing in January. What will SB 901 do when it comes to the liability of companies like PG&E and SoCal Edison?
Well, SB 901 is a bill that a conference committee that was put in place by the legislature over the summer in this past session worked through. That was a bill introduced by Senator Bill Dodd. And the conference committee, which was made up of members from the Senate and also the Assembly, went through a process of hearings to sort of determine how we needed to respond to what the utilities were bringing to us was a major concern of potential liability that would put them to the brink of bankruptcy in terms of the kinds of exposure that they would have financially. And under strict liability in the state, they could just be a little bit responsible, but 100% liable. And so trying to understand what those dynamics represented, I think that over the last couple of years, we've seen, as you pointed out, a number of your guests, just the increased magnitude of wildfires in California. And we recognize that drought conditions and climate change have basically created a new normal for California, and how we're going to respond to that becomes very critical. And so knowing that these utilities have insurance that will only take them so far, most of them somewhere between $800 million and a billion or $1.1 billion. And for 20 years where the strict liability policy has been in place or law has been in place, there have not really been any times where the damage from wildfires exceeded the insurance coverage. In 2007 in San Diego, the fires for the first time became more intense and severe and devastating. And so I think in your earlier conversation, the PUC limited in terms of what they could do when the exposure exceeded the coverage of insurance. That's when the utilities came together this year after the ruling last year by the PUC against San Diego Gas and Electric that caused them to come together, especially given the magnitude of the fires mm-hmm. from 2017.
So what would your bill, son of or cousin of SB 901, what would it do going forward?
It would essentially take just the part that was addressing the issues, the impact of the fires from 2017, where we had a securitization strategy that was put forth that would give the PUC the opportunity to evaluate, first of all, the financial viability of the utility. So they would bring their books, they would open up their books to the PUC, they would have an opportunity to do a stress test to evaluate just how much the investors would be able to pay, the utility itself would be able to pay towards these costs to the brink of bankruptcy or putting them over the edge. And then it's at that point that they would be given the opportunity to securitize the remaining costs over by floating a bond and having it paid for by ratepayer dollars over a 20-year period of time, which would break the cost down and make it less impactful than if it were to all be taken care of in one at one time.
When you chaired the Assembly Committee on this issue, when you were having your hearings on this, when you were developing last year's bill, did you give serious consideration to doing away with inverse condemnation, which holds the companies fully liable, whether they were fully to blame or not for the fire?
It was one of the subject. It was one of the topics that was on the table that we had a hearing and discussion about. The utilities were obviously interested in seeing the legislature have legislation that would relax inverse condemnation. There were trial lawyer community, the ratepayer advocates, insurance industry that obviously argued the other side of that, and the committee did not make any changes whatsoever to strict liability or inverse condemnation. And so our recommendation did not go forward making any changes, but to keep the doctrine, keep the law in place.
So, Sharon, just clarify what that means going forward.
Well, I mean, if you're talking about extending the 2017 securitization, which is a fancy way of saying we're going to borrow the money and make ratepayers pay it off. I mean, what was the discussion for having that securitization paid for by the investors and not the ratepayers?
Well, I think that that was the whole point, that by having a stress test, it would have the ratepayers pay until it hurt. So they would have to pay until
the shareholders, pay? Right.
Sorry. Yeah. The shareholders. Yeah. My apologies. The shareholders would pay until it hurts, and that would be the stress test. And that when they got to when the PUC determined that there was a point where any further pressing into that area would cause the bank would cause the destabilization, if you will, of the utility. And so there would be an opportunity to then securitize the balance over a 20-year period. That was fully vetted during that process over the summer.
Assemblyman, what is the downside to the privately held utility going under financially, declaring bankruptcy, perhaps having to give up its assets, a public entity taking its place. A number of Southern California cities, for example, have their own utilities that are publicly operated. Ratepayers keep them funded. What's the problem with SCE or PG&E being moved out of this space?
Well, I think that, but certainly that is an option. And one that we talked about and thought about this summer. We got a lot of feedback and input that suggested that that would be having the basically a bankruptcy court take over the utilities and break up the utilities was probably going to put the ratepayers in jeopardy as well and cause rates to be destabilized and also impact on a major utility in California, what that might do to the economy, contracts, and jobs that would be certainly put in jeopardy. Another approach, and I know that there's one that's being floated out there to look at possibly breaking up PG&E as an example, that is yet to be vetted. We're not quite sure exactly what all the positives are or negatives around that approach because that condition would still put in place some other entity, even if it's a public utility. And you know, having been on a public, having been a part of the city council in a city that had a public utility, has a public utility, as in Pasadena, you know, you understand that the impacts from whatever it might be going forward that could cause cost to the ratepayers, that they would have to probably absorb them. So if you have a new public entity and they have to manage the impacted area, fire impacted areas, and
they'd inherit that
fire under their control, then that would still present a problem in terms of how do you manage that in terms of reducing or mitigating impact to the ratepayers, which they would probably have to step in under that scenario. So we change from one privately owned utility to a publicly owned utility, but we still have to manage what does it mean going forward as it impacts on the ratepayers.
He's chair of the Assembly Utilities and Energy Committee, Democratic Assembly Member Chris Holden of Pasadena. Let me go back to the president and CEO of Edison International, the parent of SoCal Edison, Pedro Pizarro. Mr. Pizarro, obviously bankruptcy is the last thing you'd want to see. But what's your argument for what the public impact of that is, not just on shareholders?
That's an important question. And I think it's probably worth taking 10 seconds to just remind your listeners of what the utility model is. And frankly, whether it's a publicly owned utility like Pasadena's or Los Angeles or an investor-owned utility like ours, ultimately utilities are charged with deploying infrastructure everywhere customers are. And we have to go out and raise the capital and invest the capital, deploy it into wires and poles and transformers to connect all the houses and all the businesses in our areas, respective areas, and then operate that safely. In the case of an investor in utility like ours, that capital is coming from investors. They're fronting the capital so that the cities that we serve don't have to go and secure that capital on their own. But ultimately, we're doing this on behalf of customers, and we collect the return on and off the capital through our rates. The issue with the wildfire liability concern is this. As a utility, whether publicly owned or investor-owned like ourselves, our charge is to, to run the system safely, do it as well as we can, but the standards used across the country is one of being a prudent manager. And so let's define what the standards are under which we have to operate and make sure that we're living up to those, but recognizing that events can happen on a system that can be out of our control or in efforts.
And I'm sorry to interrupt, I just need to break, but real quickly, you feel that those standards are clear and everybody understands them the same?
I think that it's an opportunity to do better, and in fact, it's one of the very constructive elements in SB 901 that it actually now asks for a more formal set of wildfire management plans to be reviewed by the Public Utilities Commission,
okay,
against which our actions can be measured. But the very quickly, that the key point there is under the current status of inverse condemnation with strict liability, the utility, whether public or investor-owned, is held 100% liable for all the damage, all the property damage, regardless of our actions.
All right.
No-fault approach. And so I think one of the other important features of SB 901, and I give credit to the committee.
I got to have you hold that thought. I do have to break. We're talking with the president, CEO of Edison International. We'll be back with more conversation on the liability of utilities for major wildfires in California right after a live update from Hedy Lynn Hurdies. Good to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. This just in, Nancy Pelosi has been chosen by House Democrats to lead them in the new Congress. Of course, she's going to face the full House vote on her potential speakership coming up in January when the House of Representatives meets in its new session. Pelosi ran unopposed as the nominee for Speaker in the closed-door Democratic caucus election today. There were some Democratic members who wanted to see someone else in the position, but ultimately she stood for the position by herself and was nominated by Democrats, that again pending the full House vote in January. Good to have you with us on Air Talk as we look at the issue of liability by utility companies for the injuries and deaths caused by massive wildfires that have become, sadly, the recent norm here in California. The question is, for private companies, if that puts them at the brink of bankruptcy, does there have to be relief provided at the state level, with ratepayers potentially paying more or paying off bonds to enable the companies to handle their legal exposure and obligations? KPCC infrastructure correspondent Sharon McNary is with us. Sharon, let's talk about what's the role of the consumer groups been?
Well, Prop 103, I don't know if you remember that all those years ago, it built in some rules that consumers can be represented before the Public Utilities Commission by advocates who are speaking for them. And they work to keep the rates down. And so, when the utilities say we're going to invest, as Edison is doing, $582 million in hardening our system against fire, and we want ratepayers to pay that, these consumer organizations can come in and say, well, we think that's too much. You can't add $13 a year to your electricity bill. We think you're doing this is duplicative and that's too much and this is the wrong thing to do. So you'll have this clash at the Public Utilities Commission of the investor-owned utilities and then these consumer advocates. And then the commissioners have to weigh what's the best direction to go.
And one of those consumer advocacy groups is the Utility Reform Network, known as TURN. Executive Director Mark Toney. Mr. Toney, good to have you with us. How do you think the state legislature should handle this issue of utility liability?
Well, there's a couple of important principles, Larry. The first is when utilities have been found negligent, when they have not followed the safety regulations for trimming trees or maintaining their lines, when the utility is at fault, the shareholders should always pay, no matter what. That's an incredibly important principle, and one that SB 901 violated by saying that even if the utility is responsible, if the shareholders can't afford to pay one lump sum, then it's going to be put on the back of the customers. And that's just plain wrong.
So what do you think would be the alternative if the investors couldn't pay it and the company filed for bankruptcy? Would that be okay?
Well, the first thing is that if it's good enough for the ratepayers to pay over time, over 20 years, we think it's fine for the shareholders to pay over 20 years. We understand that they may not be able to pay the lump sum at once, but we're like, put them on a payment plan. So, in terms of bankruptcy is a bad thing, Okay? No, it's a bad choice. But, you know, all the choices in front of us are bad choices. Making ratepayers, making customers pay for property damage that is not our fault, that we didn't do anything to cause, that's a bad option too. So at this point, we have a lot of bad options in front of us. In terms of solutions, what Turn wants to see is the legislature to look at the big picture of wildfires. A lot of other causes, the wildfire in Redding earlier this year had nothing to do with utilities. It was a vehicle-caused fire, and we want to see a California catastrophic wildfire insurance plan that covers victims from all fires and covers them equitably, and then talk about utilities paying for those fires in which they're negligent, but in which there are true accidents, having the California Catastrophic Wildfire Fund, kind of like they have in Florida with the Hurricane Fund, to cover those property damage.
All right. Let me bring into the conversation, response to that, Travis Miller of the investment research firm Morningstar. He is the utility strategist for Morningstar. So, Mr. Miller, what about that idea of if the utility is found to be at fault for the start of the fire, that then the shareholders take on the responsibility over time of paying off all the damages?
Well, that's certainly what the market fears right now. That's why you've seen the stock price collapse. You see a lot of uncertainty around who's investing in the stock and even the bonds for PG&E, so all of the private financing that they're getting in the market. The key here is ultimately, where does the money come from, like you were discussing earlier? And it can come from a couple places. It can come from the ratepayers, as we discussed. It can come from shareholders, and it can come from the debt side or the bondholders through the securitization or any other kind of debt issue. So the key question at a financial level and what we look at in terms of investment perspective is, where's the lowest cost source of those funds? And in some cases, it could be from the market, and in that case, you need a strong stock. You need a stock that has that utility type of profile, that has preferably for investors a dividend on the shareholder side, and just more confidence in the steady rate making process that many other utilities in the U.S. already have.
So, and if utility doesn't have that degree of attractiveness for investors, that puts the utility's continued operation in uncertainty. If the investors just feel there's too much risk.
Yeah, that's certainly what we saw 2 weeks ago when the stock price collapsed so hard, that investors just lost complete confidence in the politicians, the regulators, management potentially even, to figure out a way to make PG&E a steady earnings and cash flow producer. So that uncertainty is just really deadly for any of the stocks, and particularly PG&E. It just can't raise capital in the market if there's not certainty around the value.
What's the profile of the shareholders in companies like Edison International and PG&E? Are these, large funds typically? Are a lot of them pension funds? Who typically are attracted to utilities?
Yeah, no, you're right. Typical utility investor is going to be a long-term oriented type of holder. So they want that steady cash flow. They want the dividends. They want the relative local exposure, so not international exposure. And you do see a lot of pension funds holding it. You see a lot of long-term investors. Obviously, they term them the grandma stocks for good reason, that you have a lot of retiree type of profiles. So you're losing that entire base. When you have a stock price volatility, you have the uncertainty like what PG&E faces and all of the California utilities potentially. That draws all of those long-term investors out of that stock and into other utility stocks that have more certainty.
We're talking with
trade-off.
We're talking with Travis Miller of the investment research firm Morningstar. Sharon?
Talking about volatility, it's worth noting that on November 19th, after Assemblyman Holden announced he was going to try and get another bill passed, PG&E stock went up 6.53% on that news.
So some of the people who'd fled, who were concerned about that exposure, felt that that was enough protection that they would come back.
Or speculators looking on the bounce.
Yeah, yeah. All right, good point. We'll continue our conversation on liability of utilities for the highly destructive and deadly wildfires of recent years in California. You have questions for our guests, you can put them on the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. We'll be back in 1 minute. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle. Sure hope to see you this coming Sunday. The beautiful theater at Ace Hotel, the historic venue downtown Los Angeles on Broadway. We're there 1 o'clock Sunday afternoon for the next Film Week screening, The Artist. The beautiful film, a modern classic, Oscar-winning Best Picture of 2011, The Artist, on the big screen of a historic venue. I was just talking with the location manager of the film. He said, I'm so excited to see it in the FA. I said, what's better, this film? And he found the locations for the movie, saying it was exciting to him to go see The Artist in a historic venue like the Ace. And I know you're going to feel similarly sitting in the audience. We have good tickets still available, kpcc.org/in-person, this coming Sunday at 1 o'clock, The Artist. And then afterwards, our post-film conversation is going to be great. We're going to talk about the locations of the film. We're going to talk about the state of the movie industry, which went through fundamental shift from silent to talking pictures as the 20s turned into the 30s. That's coming up Sunday 1 at the Theater at Ace. Tickets, kpcc.org/in-person. As we continue our conversation about utilities and their role in massive wildfires, one of our guests from Stanford University directs the Climate and Energy Policy Program. He's at the Woods Institute for the Environment at Stanford, Michael Wara. Thank you, sir, for being with us. We appreciate it. How do you think these utilities are going to have to adapt with climate change and the risk we're going to have massive fires year after year?
Well, I think that's the right question to be asking. You know, part of the reason the investors are spooked and the liability questions loom so large for everyone is that we have a suspicion that, you know, is kind of confirmed at this point that this could be a regular thing, right? It's not just that Napa, Sonoma, the firestorm last year was a one-off, it was a terrible thing, but it might not happen again for 20 years. Now it has happened again, and the Thomas Fire has had, in a sense, a repeat with the Woolsey Fire in Southern California, and this is kind of a statewide, annual, ongoing problem. The challenge is that utilities don't actually earn that much money relative to these liabilities, right? PG&E's profits are about $2 billion a year. The Napa-Sonoma fires probably caused $10 to $15 billion worth of damage, similar numbers for the Camp Fire. So, you know, multiples of the annual earnings. And as investors look at that, they say, oh, that's not something I want to own, a stock that makes $2 billion and loses $15 billion a year. And so we need to come up with solutions to the fire problem. And by solving that problem, we will solve the financial liability questions and the sort of ongoing utility financial questions as well. And I think only by really addressing the roots of the problem and doing it fast. We don't have a lot of time to do this. We need to do this right away because, you know, what happened in Paradise is just unacceptable, I think, from the state's perspective. And it's certainly, you know, unacceptable from
every way you look at it.
Every way you look at it. And I think there are opportunities to solve the problem, right? We know that we need to do better vegetation management. That's something that's going to take years, realistically. We know that PG&E and Edison, and to maybe a lesser degree, only because they've acted sooner, San Diego Gas and Electric can do things to harden their systems. But I also think that we need to have a serious conversation about how we use the electricity system in these high wildfire risk areas.
What do you mean by that?
What I mean is that we assume the lights are going to stay on and they're going to be on all the time. and we plan accordingly, right? I think we need to move to a system where we're much more accepting of a blackout occurring on a semi-regular basis, possibly for multiple days at a time, because of wildfire risk. It's better to have the lights go out a few days a year, or maybe even a day or two a month during wildfire season, and avoid this kind of catastrophe than it is to leave them on all the time and hope for the best and hope that the tree trimming was done perfectly.
But with the weather conditions we have in wildfire areas, realistically, you'd be doing this multiple days a year.
Yes.
And there are health consequences to de-energizing the lines. There are people who need electricity for health needs, you know, pumps and, you know.
I completely agree. And this is where California actually, you know, has developed the solutions. We can provide a solution set that wasn't possible 5 or 10 years ago because of the innovation that has occurred in the state with respect to using batteries, you know, behind the meter in people's homes, at customers, at businesses, and combining that with distributed energy solutions where we generate power to charge the batteries. And that's going to really soften the impact. And I think a kind of a crash program, sort of an Apollo program, to reframe, restructure how we use and how we get the energy that we need to do all the essential services. I mean, drive, you know, provide power to medical devices, keep emergency services up, keep the cell phone and internet up during these crises, right? We need a crash program to make it okay to turn off the power.
Would this affect CAISO, the state's independent system operator, which has the long-distance transmission lines? Would you argue they should de-energize too at certain times?
We need to seriously consider that.
You know,
there may be other solutions for the big transmission lines that are viable. It may be possible to harden them and increase setbacks in ways that are feasible for the small number of high voltage lines, but are just infeasible for the hundreds of thousands of miles of distribution circuits that we have in the state.
I mean, because that could affect millions of people.
It could, absolutely. And it does appear, right, the problems that were reported to the PUC by PG&E that maybe, you know, might have led to the campfire are on a high voltage line. We need to have a process in place to de-energize those if there's risk. And I think that is a separate issue that needs to be addressed. But it just seems clear we need to be thinking out of the box as a state and about how to solve this electricity-caused wildfire problem. It has grown very large over the last years, and it's gotten to the point where it's in no one's interest to be penny wise and pound foolish anymore.
Michael Wara of Stanford, thank you so much for being with us. I want to thank all of our guests who've given so much of their time to spend an entire hour talking about this important issue with the future of California. Sharon McNary, KPCC infrastructure correspondent. Final word about what you see as the most important developments early into 2019.
Well, it does seem that utilities are now taking far more seriously the need to de-energize power to affected areas, so much so that Edison is installing little tiny weather stations on its circuits out in its rural area so that it can actually know what the wind speed is, know what the precipitation is, know what the humidity is, so that maybe it can then just turn off a couple miles of electrical circuit
and
rather than the whole.
And they're doing big insulation of their lines and investing millions in that,
and of course
too.
Their customers will pay for that.
Yeah, all right. We end up paying one way or the other, seems like. Sharon, thank you so much.
You
appreciate
bet.
It. Thank you for joining us on Air Talk for our in-depth conversation today. Fresh Air with Terry Gross comes up next. I'll be back with you tomorrow morning at 10 for the next Air Talk.